Hi, everyone. My name is Doug, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon and a grateful member of AA. So, and I'm going to talk a little bit about my childhood first. I'll give you a little understanding of how I grew up and how I became what I was. And I grew up in Los Angeles, California, North Hollywood, San Fernando Valley. I'm the baby of the family. I had two sisters, one 17 years older than I was, one 16 years older than I was. And when my mom was pregnant, you could imagine what they're saying, "Mom, you can't come to our graduation, you're pregnant." You know, that's, you know, being so old, you know, my mom was almost 40 when she was pregnant with me. And so my sister was kind of embarrassed about that. But my dad, then I had two brothers that are 7 years older, one 7, 1 5. And my brother is seven years older than I am. We're the only two survivors around here. Everybody else has passed away. So I was a baby family, and we saw all sorts of different things. My dad, I can't say he was alcoholic. He was probably a problem drinker. My mom, looking back at everything, my mom was a great enabler to have him to continue doing that. You know, I remember being young and like 9, 10 years old, my mom wanted to go to the World's Fair. They had the World's Fair up here in 1964. My mom wanted to go, let's go to the World's Fair. Let's go to Alaska. She's saying all these things. And sure, Mom, yeah, let's go. Let's do it. Never happened, but that was her dream because she was, looking back on it, she was really disappointed in her marriage and her life marriage to this, my dad, who was a brilliant guy, but he was a drunk, right? And my mom was an RN, short at the County USC Medical Center at the County Regional Hospital in LA. And that's where she retired from. And my dad had a good job. He was a general manager of a great big machine shop. And but the guy closed the business down, so he started his own business. And he was a brilliant guy, but he wasn't a good businessman. You know what I mean? He'd go to the bars and you know, you just don't manage businesses, you know, when you're getting drunk. And so he wasn't a good businessman. So he lost a few businesses, one due to health and other things. My mom was the breadwinner. She was really supporting the whole family. And I remember being young, you know, and she, you know, if I got hurt or something like that, remember, Doug, big boys don't cry. You're a big boy. So I learned how not to cry. I learned how not to feel. I learned how not to do those things. You know, that was the thing because my mom didn't have time for that. You know, my mom worked all the different shifts. You know, when I was going to school, she worked the night shift, graveyard shift, and come home, get me off to school, and sleep on the couch, and get up, and you know, get ready to make dinner and all that other stuff. And because my dad didn't help, he was at the bar. But I learned this later on. When I got of driving age, my mom would send me out to the bar to go pick my dad up. Go get your dad, he's drunk, and I don't want him driving home. Go do this. And I learned later on that my siblings did the same thing. So I don't know how long it had been going on. And my dad, when he would get drunk, he'd sit down and tell me how good he was and how bad I was. You know, he'd tell me, you just think God, you're just no good. And he did that. And I learned later on, he did that with all the other kids too, you know, my brothers and sisters. And my brother, 7 years old, he went to the Marine Corps and went to Vietnam and all that stuff. And come back, and he's going to go to college, and my dad told him, "You're too dumb to go to college." He made a call home from Vietnam one time, and you know how to, I don't know if you ever war veterans, how you make a call home from a war situation. It's kind of hard, you know. And he got on the phone, and he didn't even, "Oh, I'll get your mom." You know, he didn't want to talk to him. You know, that's what my dad was. He was just, didn't, you know, no love, no nothing. So I had a pretty dismal childhood as far as that. We didn't do anything. If I wanted to go to scouts or go play Little League or anything like that, I was, you know, I had to do it on my own. It was pretty much a free-range chicken, you know. And and I went to go play, you know, baseball and all our stuff. And went to scouts, rode my bike, you know, go to scouts and all that other stuff. But it was all on my own. My dad never, you know, did anything. So I learned at home, my oldest sister had a heart problem, and she was disabled from it, right? But she taught me how to cook, how to sew, mend clothes, mend my socks, sew buttons on, whatever. She took care of me, taught me how to cook, and all that other stuff. So I was very grateful for that. But she was very she had to live at home, and she was very disappointed that she was disabled. And I'm not sure the whole story, but my older sister, before she passed away, she was telling me that maybe she was misdiagnosed. But she had open heart surgery back in the 60s at UCLA. And she was one of the early heart surgery people. But the doctor maybe had misdiagnosed it. I'm not sure. Okay. Hold on. So the doctor maybe misdiagnosed or something like that, but she could not work. She didn't have energies. You know, she'd get tired very easily. But she was very upset about that because she wanted to be independent. So there's lots of fights going around in the house. My parents would tell her, "You're disabled, you can't do that. You can't do that, you're disabled." You kept telling her, "No, no, no." And I'd always try to be the peacemaker. That's what I learned to be, because I hated the arguments. I was trying to be the peacemaker. And I did the best I could. But that was a survival thing for me, just to get out of the house and be peaceful. And when I started, my first job was working at a liquor store. And, stop here, back then we used to have returnable bottles. And I was the bottle shack king, And so I had to separate all the bottles and get them all ready so the distributors could come and stack all the bottles. And every once in a while I was 11 years old, and I got $5 a week. And $5 a week back then, it's a lot of money. I'd go see 35 cents to go see two movies, at the theater, and go play slot cars and all sorts of things. So I was pretty rich. And he asked me to stock pull the beer in the cooler. And I was I've done that several times, and I got a little malt liquor drink and took it out there and drank it, and I liked it, and that's how I got started, in alcohol. And I felt the warmness of it and whatnot. So I ended up getting another job closer to home. Doing the same thing, cleaning up. And as I grew older, I'd be one of those guys outside the liquor store. Hey, would you buy me a six-pack? I had money, right? I could buy that. And you guys would do that. You would oblige me. Yeah. And me and my buddies would drink, So that's how I started drinking. And when I drank, I didn't care about what my dad was telling me. I didn't care about what he was saying. So that's how I got involved in alcohol. So that's what I'm going to go there, but that was my storyline. I drank alcoholically and whatnot. I ended up getting married. My first wife, that was in 76. And my first wife knew I had a lot of bad influences with, people down there. And so we decided, got my apprenticeship. I had enough, years of experience. A lot of companies used to go down there and hire people, the labor pools, and go to work. And so I ended up getting hired by a company in Reno, Nevada, which is called Grove Valve and Regulator. We made oil valves for Alaska Pipeline and all that stuff. And we did a lot of offshore stuff and things like that. So I was working as a machinist there. And so everything was going pretty good. And I even got tracked into a church in 79. And I got sober, I had a spiritual experience, and I got sober in about, July of 79. Then around early 81, I edged God out. Things were really going good, and I wanted to be like these other people, and I just totally edged God out and ended up, destroying that job. The oil industry kind of collapsed, and after Jimmy Carter, and that kind of closed the business too. So the business ended up leaving. So I ended up getting divorced, drinking that marriage away. Good wife, but I blamed it on, you heard me earlier, I blamed it on, astrological signs. I didn't blame it on, alcohol and things like that. I'm buying a house, I got a good job, I'm making good money, and I had to buy her out, so I ended up working two jobs, working at a little AM/PM market, and, on the weekends, so pay all the bills off. I gave my wife a car, took all the debt, and, paid her off the equity of the house, and, so that was it. And a friend of mine, I used to go down to L.A. to see my parents and whatnot. They're in their late 70s. And friend of mine took me to a meeting in North Hollywood, Studio City Park, and Laurel Canyon Park over there, Laurel Canyon, Victory Boulevard. And that's where I went to my first meeting. I thought it was great for Fred, because Fred and I, we grew up together. It was Fred, Frank, and John. We all went to elementary school, junior high, high school. We grew up, and some of us are still friends today. We still communicate. And Fred, he was a bad drug, I tell you. I was really happy to see him. He was doing a lot of heavy drugs, too. And he kicked his habit and alcoholism and AA. So I was very happy for him. He sent me a big book that year for a Christmas present. And, love you, Doug. I still got it at home, it was great. And I ended up getting sober in 93, or 83, excuse me. That was in 81 he sent me a big book. So April 83 is when I got sober. That's when that was my bottom right hit. But I had a problem there. It wasn't for this guy named Red C. It was a Skid Row wino. My version of an alcoholic was a Skid Row wino. That's what I saw growing up in L.A., and that's what I envisioned, not as someone who was working, making money, and all this other stuff. So it was a kind of a thing. And Red, I was telling Red after meeting, because I didn't have a sponsor, I was just going to meetings. And Red said to me, I told him, I said, I don't know if I'm as sick as you guys. And Red, had 24 years. He was one of these guys, the hobos that run the freights up and down California picking vegetables and stuff and fruit. That's what he did, And he got sober in Sacramento, but he moved to Reno because it's cheaper to live up there. And he's a little, about 5'6", 140 pounds, redhead, freckles. And so he grabbed me and took me over to the Third Tradition. He said, the only desire you have to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is the desire to quit drinking. He said, you got a problem with drinking, so why do you want to go out and lose everything? And a kind of light bulb hit me, and, he said, you got to be grateful you got sober so young. He kicked me in the butt and said, go get yourself a sponsor and a home group. And that's what I did. So that's when my life started changing. Then we used to have this, I used to rent rooms out at my house to help with bills and whatnot. So I rent rooms out and had this one lady rent a room named Chris F. And Chris and my future wife were friends. And they used to have a meeting at the Dryers Club. I was always a big hit of club. That's where I got sober at. And, besides the other meeting, that's a good safe harbor. And so they had a midnight meeting. That's when I saw this cute nurse in a white uniform and whatnot and all that stuff. And I said, and that's Chris's friend, my roommate's friend. So I'm trying to get her to introduce me. So we finally met. And as I was going to my home group, which is Monday Night Young People's down there, and we used to go out and do things as a group, right? So we'd go bowling and stuff, go dancing. And I learned in that group how to be a gentleman, how to go out and date a person, right? So I knew how to go out and date my wife. I wasn't after, just getting in bed with her. So that was a tremendous, that's what we learned, and it was a good experience. So it was wonderful. But that's how home groups can help you. But anyway, so we started, I'll get honest, That's, yeah, no. So we ended up dating, getting married in 1987. Started having our first kid in 88, second one in 91, I should say. And everything's going good. We bought a new house. She wanted to get a new house. We sold my old house. We bought a new house. We're making good money. A big dream of mine was learning how to fly airplanes. We could afford it. So I got my pilot's license, right? It's a big goal of mine. And I'm also riding motorcycles and all that other stuff, and had a Harley at the time. I remember a sponsor coming over. This is in about the summer of 92. And she came in the room. I worked nights as a shift supervisor in a machine shop. And she goes, you're loaded. And I turned and looked, and I didn't even know. But she, you know, she knew that Christy was loaded. She was another addict alcoholic. And I'm, you know, not familiar with that. And, man, my world crumbled, right? I just, oh, man, what's going on here? And because I had an expectation of being Mr. and Mrs. AA. I wanted to have white picket fence and everything nice. You know, there was four of us that got married, had the same home group, two of us, you know, are still married. And I just had, that was my expectation, my vision, you know. And there are some couples like that, and I wanted to be one of those couples. I wanted to be. See what I'm saying? I wanted. My expectation. And my sponsor at the time, Mike Guess, I didn't know it, and I was telling Mike that, gosh, you know, Mike, you know, I'm almost 9 years sober, and I'm saying, I know what I need to do. I need to sponsor her. I know where she, you know, I'll make sure she gets on these steps. And that was my plan. And Mike's looking at me, he said, you crazy son of a bitch. And he took me to an Al-Anon meeting. And that was September of 92. And that's why I, you know, learned about Al-Anon. And so it's been Christy went into treatment in 92. And then we went to some counseling after that, and we learned how to fight, how to have arguments, you know. I feel hurt when you, I feel mad, or I feel, you know, throwing marshmallows, you know, that's what they want. You throw marshmallows at each other, you know, express your feelings. And, marshmallows would not spoil, you know, they last for 1,000 years. So if you don't get them all up, it's not going to hurt nothing. So that worked for us for a little bit, you know, and whatnot. And we started going, you know, going to meetings and whatnot, and it was good. Everything is going good again. And Christy, we went on vacation in 95, and we went up to Yellowstone, and I took her on places I went on my motorcycles with. You know, we went to Yellowstone and up to, we came up here. We had our two kids and stuff, and she kind of liked the area, and we thought, well, you know, heck, we could move. That's no big deal. I get a job anywhere as a machinist, you know. And she, she lost her license as an RN, so due to her drug use, you know. She was the first nurse to be put on a contract in the state of Nevada, and that put a lot of pressure on her, learned later on. But they would put nurses under contract, and, you know, they'd have to do certain things, go to diversion and all sorts of. She'd be better off telling you about that than me. But it cost money, so that was my big thing. Because I paid the bills. Yeah, I was the bill payer. She was the, I wrote the checks. And then she lost. So we really needed to downsize. And so moving wasn't a bad idea. I think she wanted to get out of Reno anyway. I didn't mind getting out of Reno, but I loved the dirt bike riding, you know, because I rode street and dirt. You know, I did a lot of dual sport riding and stuff like that. And desert, so I really enjoyed that. But so we vacationed up here, and we liked the area. We were going to move to Post Falls and looked at several houses, and then we found out the school district really sucked, so we ended up moving to Spokane because there's an old retirement neighborhood, and they weren't voting no taxes in, and, you know, so we ended up over here, and so that worked out. We sent Christy up to come get a house, and I think she has come up. She has cousins up here. And she ended up, I think she was still inebriated at the time, using drugs and whatnot, and I think she swallowed her crown or something like that on the way up, and gold crown, and, you know, that's kind of a mess. And so she had a little story to talk about that, but I think I could go too far into that. But anyway, we ended up moving up here in 96, and which was, you know, I enjoyed it. It's been a good move for us, a good place to raise the kids. And Christy, when we moved up here, April B., who stood up over there a little while ago, she knows Christy. She's about the first AA person that Christy met. And she probably seen Christy at her worst and her best. You know, and Christy's been in and out, in and out. She'd go, what she told me, she'd go in the bathroom, shoot up, and come back to go to the meeting, you know, and stuff like that. So anyway, I'm going to Al-Anon. I started going to Al-Anon down there, and when I came up here, I used to go to the 12 step club on post, They had good Al-Anon meetings there. The Alano Club here is a three-story building up by the hospital, and it's smoky and heck, and I had quit smoking by then, so I just couldn't go there. But the 12-step club on what's now Pizzeria, that closed in 98. So I started to go back to church again, now everything was going good. Then, I'm working my program and all this other stuff. The bishop would call and, hey, your wife's loaded. I think she's maybe, going into the medicine cabinet, stealing some drugs or something, helping, being that good neighbor, helping people. And but being a nurse, she knows what it is. And so I get it's all about me. It's like the anger I would get because of the trust that was violated, right? It wasn't working like I was working with another alcoholic or nothing like that. It was my trust was violated with her. Everything, and that's what got me in the valley. I used to search the house for drugs and all this other stuff. And, it's just crazy. And she got arrested in October of 2002. For forging a prescription. She'd go to the doctor's office, steal a prescription pad. She'd been doing that for a while. And so she got busted, arrested for that. And I'm learning stuff about I'm not enabling. I'm getting a little self-love. And so I let her sit in jail. She wouldn't bail her out. And, so I let her sit in jail. Let her have some consequences for her actions. And she called me up. I tell her, hey, you're a homeowner. You're a wife, you've got history in the town, they're going to let you out on your own reconnaissance, whatever that word is. And I said, don't worry about it. So she gets out of jail, and me and the kids, my two youngest, we go down there and pick her up, because I want them to know what's going on. I'm not a liar. I want an open thing. The kids they need to know. And another thing, I have to go back to Reno a little bit. When she was used, she in our second child, she was using during the pregnancy. So I made her go to the doctor and tell the doctor, all that stuff so we'd watch, the development of the child. And, those kind of things really upset me. He turned out all right, except he's got red hair and freckles, But that's the thing. Once in a generation of my family, everybody gets that. So he's the one. But so I let her sit in jail and just let her, because I learned stuff about not enabling and let her suffer from consequence. I wasn't going to go rescue her. That's what you do in Ellen. We don't rule rescue people. My mom used to rescue my dad, and I used to go rescue him as well. I'd be the guy that, go down there and pick him up. When I got a DUI in Los Angeles, he didn't rescue me. I called him up. The bar where I left was the one to rescue me, bailed me out of jail. My dad wouldn't rescue me. I said, well, that's kind of odd. Why wouldn't he help me? I helped him many times. But anyway, so Christy got out of jail, and went to treatment again. Not inpatient, but outpatient through the court system because they put her in drug court. That was a new thing. Thank you. And so she had to go through a thing like that. And did it work? Well, no. In October, later on, in 2002, she was still doing the same old stuff, in and out. She just wander off and go places. I didn't follow around. I gave up on stuff. I'm slowly losing the urge to go search the house. I'm getting better at it. I'm letting things go. I am working the program. I'm having some serenity even though she's using. That was the big thing for me. I wasn't going crazy. I wasn't this alcoholic just rent space in my mind, just addict. So that was a good thing for me. So I'm slowly getting healthier. And that was good for me and the kids, And I took over all the finances. I divorced her from all the finances completely then. She had her own checking account and own money. Then she started stealing the kids. I forgot about this one, but the kids had college funds, So the money out of the college funds went, she got into that. And I had to pay that back to the kids. But so, yeah, it was kind of a a wild thing, but this is all the things, you know, she'd never tell the truth. Addict, that's what we do. Addicts and alcoholics, we don't tell, how many beers you have? A couple. You know, are you loaded? No, I'm fine. You know, that's the same old thing, you know, so they never tell the truth, so I got used to that. But I would look at her mannerisms and her, I could tell when she was loaded. You know, I could tell when she had, when she was using opiates. There's just certain things that she would do. And so again, back in 2011, now this is something that's kind of odd, but I'll share it. It was a spiritual experience. I woke up in the middle of the night, just around December 3rd, had to go pee. I went and go to the bathroom and go pee. And I had this mental thing come in my head, I'm going to voice her thought, says, go check your wife's purse. Right? I was clear as that. I mean, so I finished in the bath, washed hands, turned on the light in the bedroom, opened up her purse, and here's her kit, her drugs, her, you know, her syringes, everything right there. Right? And that's led to another thing. So I had a spiritual experience there, but it wasn't for me, it was for her. She didn't know that then. But God was just an instrument in helping her. So we ended up kicking her out of the house. I did, you know, because she didn't want to commit. She went over to her user, her supplier's house, and she ended up going to treatment again, inpatient. And did that work? No. We've been together 37 years, knowing each other 38 and or 39, and she's got 7 years. No, you know. So, yeah. So, around, the Halloween of 2012, she's drinking, you know. And the kids and I, we all know, we're seeing the shoes, you know, we're seeing at the table, slurring. My son had to pick her up off the bathroom, and one time she was so drunk she couldn't get up. And so, you know, there's no secrets going on. So she wanted help, and I said, you know what, I am not going to pay any more treatment. You know, I probably spent $50,000 over the years of, you know, all the bills and everything, and I said, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to sober you up here. Down to the Dryers Club in Reno, they used to sober people up there. Now, this is old-timers, how they did it and whatnot. They'd share stories, and so Chrissy's going crazy, so I detoxed right on. I took 2 days off of work, and detox right home, solely with vodka. And she went through heebie-jeebies and all that stuff and saw the spiders. And it's, what, 2 days, 3 days?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was, yeah, she'll shadow people and all sorts of things. And I told her, if something happens, I will take you, I will call 911. We'll get you something. But, you know, and that was a good thing because she ended up trusting me more. It wasn't the enemy. She built trust up there. And so it was a good thing, you know, and we detoxed her at home, and everything was going pretty good. In 2016, I had a knee replacement surgery, and, you know, if you ever, you know, maybe you had those, but they, you know, they cut your knee, it's very painful surgery, and they tell you when you get out of there, you got to use your pain meds, or you won't do the physical therapy, and the physical therapy you need to do, all right? So I did that, and I got off my pain meds pretty soon, and, you know, started going to Tylenol and Advil and whatnot, or Tylenol, I should say, no, Advil. And coming to find out, I had a sore one time. I looked in there, and all the pain pills were gone. Yeah. And I said, you know, she replaced them with something that looked like them, but they weren't, you know, the same thing. I didn't take them. I go, what the hell is this? And so she confessed to me that I got something I got to tell you. You know, I stole your pain meds. I said, I knew that. And then I said to her, I said, that's the most honest you've ever been to me. You know, I've never, you know, she's always lied. I didn't get mad. I said, that's just wonderful how honest you're with me. I'm just glad to hear that, you know, you open up. And that's what Al-Anon allowed me to do. I didn't have to get mad. I didn't get disappointed or nothing. I was just, you know, happy that she come clean, you know. And that was 7 years ago, December 30th, that she said that. That's why she changed the date. So, yeah. What I've learned in Al-Anon, which has been good for me, that expectations, you know, I'm a school bus driver now. I've been driving school bus for 4 years because there's a big shortage of school bus drivers, by the way, if you're looking for a job. Part-time job is a good job, but I'll tell you, the program has helped me tremendously because I can detach from these kids. I don't have expectations. You know, I'm serious. You know, I can detach from these kids. And so they try to nibble and, you know, I'm just, okay, we're going to rearrange the seating and move you guys around. And, you know, they're always doing that. And then I just write them up. I got cameras on the bus. And so anyway, I've learned a lot about that. So I don't have expectations about drivers on the road. I used to get, you know, mad, flip you off and all that stuff. Now I don't, you know. I remember one time this guy was tailgating me and he passed me and I flipped him off. He flipped me off. And I said, gosh, well, that was horrible. What if I had to go do a 12-step call on that guy? Yeah, I remember. You're the one who flipped. You know, I don't want to be that guy that, you know, if I, you know, have that memory, you know. And so that was a wonderful thing. So I don't want to, you know, I didn't do that. So I have no expectations about it. You can drive the way you want. I'm okay with that. I'm not in your shoes. But when it's personal, I had to do some self-love with my kid, too. I had a 16-year-old kid, who's my youngest, who didn't want to go to school, right? Quit, dropped out of high school. Couldn't get him to do online school. Getting in trouble, going downtown to the bus depot, and the police would bring him back one night, and, you know, hey, your son's stealing bikes and smoking pot, and, you know, here, you better talk to him. You know, he's jumping out the window, get down there. And so I kind of did, so we changed locks. I kicked him out of the house and, you know, told him, you know, you're out of here. Turn him over to the juvenile court. And a little tough love. Let him. He went and surfed on some couches for a month and a half or a couple months, and he came back willing, all right? But I still couldn't get him to go to school. So I got him, you know, dads try to talk to kids. Doesn't work. You know, they don't like to listen to that. He's never seen me drunk, never seen anything. I've shared my story with him, many, you know, the whole story about it. I've done everything. You can't hide nothing. There's nothing that you're not going to surprise me with. And but he won't listen. So I take him down and he said, well, you got to get a job if you're not going to school. So I got him a job at Dick's Hamburgers. He had a friend that worked there, so he worked at Dick's Hamburgers. And this lady, I don't know if you know Dick's and this restaurant next door to it, but her name is Linda, and Linda mentored my son, and he worked there for like 9 years, and he was the highest paid employee. He learned the responsibility, he was taking care of the money, and, you know, doing all sorts of, you know, cleaned up the place at night janitor, security guy. And she finally caught him when he was about 26, says, or 25, says, Michael, this is not a career, you know. This is a hamburger joint. You got to go out and grow. You know, I've been trying to tell them that forever, but this lady mentored my son, and she, you know, I'm just so ungrateful. Michael has totally turned around. He's a great kid. He's doing air conditioning and heating now. He's, you know, doing wonderful, you know, saving to buy a house. Really wise guy, wants to get investing. You know, he's 32 years old and really doing good. And, so I can't, you know, complain. My other son, you know, he, you know, got involved in pot. He got arrested and all that other stuff, and for distribution, and, you know, was doing meth and stuff. But he's all off of that now. Went to school, back to school. Got himself he's a millwright now. He got himself doing that, and he's really happy. And he's off all that stuff. But the one thing I really learned, I don't give advice to my kids unless they ask for it. I wanted to tell them what they needed to do. I wanted to constantly tell them, you need to do this, you need to do that, you know. I needed to shut up and just listen, let them talk, you know. And so that's what I do today. And it's hard because I'm a control guy. I want to share my experiences, you know. I want to share my wisdom. But if they don't want to hear it, they're not going to hear it, you know. So I just got to learn to listen, let them ask. You know, when they want to hear that stuff. You know, and what is wisdom? It's knowledge practice over and over and over and over again, you know. So, you know, I've learned that even though I got a lot to share, a lot to offer, unless they want to hear it, I can't share it, you know. And but I still find with my wife, Here recently, she went to a dental appointment. I work part-time. I work in the morning, I come home, and I work in the afternoon, take kids home from school. And she was going to a dental appointment. I come home from work about 5 o'clock, and she's not there. No call, no message, or anything like that. And all these old thoughts start coming back. You know, just like she was using, because they're still there, and they're easy to reach for. Oh, God, what happened now? You know, am I going to get the phone call? Am I going to, you know, where is she at? Well, she's at the thrift store and shopping, and she made another friend there, but she never called or anything like that. And I had to explain to her, you know, that, gosh, it'd be nice to let me know, because all these old feelings come back, because that's what she used to do. You know, this is, you know, and I hate to say it, but, you know, to let these old feelings go, I wish I could just let them go, but they're still there. You know, they're easy to grab onto, easy behaviors. I could sit there and grab the old lashing behaviors and say, you know, start criticizing or just being very strict and stern or loud with my voice and things like that, and be angry with my body language and stuff, and it doesn't do any good for her. You know, it doesn't do any good for the alcoholic, you know. And her family, she's the only one there, black sheep, I guess, in the family, you might say that. Her family said, why do you stay with her, you know? And I said, well, you know, I wrote her dad a letter, and this kind of sums it up, you know, because they wanted to know, because they were up, you know, they dealt with her too. And I said, well, you know, if she had illness like cancer or something of that nature or anything else, would I just throw out? You know, I had to think that. I had a wedding vow for better, you know, for worse, and sickness and in health and all that stuff. And I never drew the line, because if I knew I drew a line in the sand and she crossed it, I'd have to act on it. If I didn't, then everything was meaningless. So I never drew that line in the sand that I was going to sit there and leave her. You know, I just tried to be supportive of her. But I still find it easier, you know, I'm still working on that stuff, working on expectations still with her, because I have, that's where usually where my expectations come in with my wife. Like, I went to help out and do a volunteer thing at a local church, and so I'll have the bed ready, right? And come home, the bed's not ready. And she, well, I cleaned it off. I had all my clothes piled. You know how women are. And then I got to, you know, they're changing clothes, pulling stuff around, you know. And I didn't think, but she's, what's she doing? She's trying to get dressed and look good for me, and for her, you know. And because we're a couple. But I was a little, my expectation was I couldn't go to bed, because I go to bed early, you know. But here I can't go to bed, so I have to help, you know. So I was a little stern, a little curt. And, but that's just old behaviors. And it takes, like Julie was saying, you know, we got to change this mind. It's all up in here, change our thought patterns. And that just takes practice and practice and practice. And until it goes. And it's a, you know, one of my, I don't know what time I got here. All right. There's enough, you know, I learned, and I didn't cause her addiction. I can't control her addiction. And I surely can't, you know, cure it. You know, that's really what it comes down to. It is what it is. And I just got to be supportive and loving and help her along. And I'm just grateful for all the friends she has in AA that have helped her through all this time, because I tell you, they've seen her through the, you know, the best and the worst. You know, it's she has quite a story. And I am grateful for Al-Anon for helping me. And I like to, one of my favorite stories in AA is the Keys to the Kingdom. I just love that story. By Sybil, or not Sybil. Yeah, thank you. Oh, gosh. Sylvia K. And, you know, she's talking about, and I'm just going to read this because I just love it. You guys may have heard it, maybe not. I'll read it anyway, though. AA is not, whoop, get the glasses on with that age. AA is not a plan for recovery that can be finished and done with. It is a way of life. It's a challenge, and the challenge contained in its principles is great enough to keep any human being striving for as long as he lives or she. We do not or cannot outgrow this plan. And that's the same. I feel the same way with Al-Anon. You know, that should be AA and Al-Anon. You know, we can't. There's enough room to continuously grow, and that's what this program is all about. It's about being for me, it's about being a better Doug, a better husband, a better father, a better worker. You know, it's easy to get tied up in the work, you know, all the politics at work and stuff. I don't get involved in that. You know, I don't say bad things about anyone, you know. If I got nothing good to say, I'm not going to say anything. And there's a lot of people, all the gossip, and I just don't get involved in that anymore. And it used to be a big part because, yeah, I like to talk about that stuff, you know, sure. You know, what's going on? What's the secrets? But no, it's not. It's none of my business. And that's the way I look at my. I look what's in my hula hoop. The only thing I got control of is about right here, you know, right in front of that hand. I have no control of anything beyond that. And that's something I learned because I am a control freak. That's how I saved myself as a kid. I wanted to control my environment. That gave me safety, you know. So anyway. The more I work on me, this is not my original, the better you get. And that's Jim D, who lives in Post Falls, and his wife was my sponsor's, Al-Anon sponsor. And I know Jim, he used to live in Reno, and we used to always, you know, Jim's got, what, 55, 56 years now? And, yeah, he was kind of a great guy. I worked with him opening a new club down there. It was called the Triangle Club, a sustaining member, you know, helped funneled money into it to keep it going until it got going by itself. And but that's what he used to always say. He said it down there and he says it up here. The more I work on me, the better you get. And that's the truth. You know, the better you get when I work on me. And that's, you know, and that's what Al-Anon is, a different view. It's a different angle, camera angle, than what AA is. And I learn more about me. I learn more about my self-centeredness, my selfishness, and my expectations, things that my triggers and stuff, and it's been really good for me for that. And I can let my wife and you live and let live. I can let it be, and I could have my own serenity and my own happiness and everything. You know, I used to be the type of person where if you didn't smile at me, I said, what's wrong with me? You know, that was all that stuff growing up with my dad. Like, if a boss walked by me, Lloyd didn't say. I said, "Hi, Lloyd," and Lloyd didn't say anything. You know, he's 20 miles down the road thinking of a problem. He's out of the shop, and I'd think, "What's wrong with me? Why didn't he say hi to me?" You know, that's how low my self-esteem was. You know, and all that stuff. I tried to make everything about me. You know, but it wasn't about me. So, hope you enjoyed my little talk. That's my Al-Anon story. That's how I got there, and I continue to go. I'm grateful for my friends. I'm grateful for Kelly. Kelly's been a very good friend, and. And I got some new friends with Kevin, and I can't remember where they are. Anyway, I've got new friends. We all, you know, but there's only about 12 meetings a week of Al-Anon. And think in Spokane, you think of all, there's about 160 AA meetings. You know, I mean, the Pebble and Pond, and I've gone and spoke at treatment centers to the family after groups. And, you know, people go to treatment and they think it's like going to the doctor, get a pill, you get your antibiotics, and you're all cured. You know, and I don't have the problem. They have the problem. And getting guys to go to Al-Anon is even more trouble because, you know, we like to fix things. I wanted to fix my wife. You know, I was going to fix her. You know, I was going to sponsor her. You know? Yeah, but that's, you know, we try to take care of things. Then reaching out for help is another thing. You know, guys, we don't reach out for help like we should. And my sponsor shared something with me. You know, who gave you the right? This is down in Reno, my guest. He said, who gave you the right to deny someone else the blessings they get to help you? Yeah. Isn't this what this program is about, helping one another? So we need to reach out. And that's one of my frailties, you know, something I don't do enough is reach out. But anyway, that's something I find that a lot of men don't do, you know, so that's why I bring that up. It's easy when you need to jump on your car or something like that, or, you know, maybe help moving, but when you're going through a rough time or something like that, you need to reach out. So, And I've had some rough times, and Kelly's been there for me. So, but that's how all in all works. You know, Kelly talked about, we tried to start a men's meeting before, we call it Tuesday Night Stag. And it was going good. We had about 12, 15 guys coming, you know, and it was really going good. Then COVID hit, and it kind of disbanded. Then the club wasn't open. We have our meeting at the Alano Club, so it wasn't open. They started open again on Wednesday, so we started meeting on Wednesday. We used to meet in the parking lot with some just lawn chairs, you know, and we'd have a few people come, and that was, but kept the meeting going before it got cold. Then we'd go back, you know. And so we had to change the meeting to Wednesday night now and start to pick up and go good again. But Al-Anon is, there should be twice as many people in Al-Anon there are in here, because it affects every one of us. You know, it was written, you know, to the family afterward, how everybody gets sick. We're all toxic, you know, it's a toxic environment. And so anyway, that's all my story. I hope you enjoyed it. So thank you.